the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Medina. We're going to kick off today talking about our trip out west. We're also going to talk about the media cover-up of the Epstein affair and what's going on with that. The never-ending school day proposed by Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. And we'll get into a little bit of Governor Cooper and a few other things. Brooke, what's going on? Tell me about the out west trip. I went out there too, but you were out there first because I got delayed in Houston overnight.
You poor thing.
I know.
I kept getting text messages from Ray. I was already in Colorado Springs. It was for a big policy conference, and I kept getting text messages from Ray telling me that he had been delayed and had to miss a special podcast recording with Cato, and so it felt so bad. But it was really, really cold. It was a beautiful part of the state, beautiful part of the country, Colorado Springs, absolutely gorgeous, but 5 degrees wearing a skirt and heels and like winter coat just wasn't cutting it. And so it was tough.
Yeah, it was a little cold when I finally did get out there. It was a little cold, but it didn't bother me too much. I walked around in just my sport cut top and slacks and was able to suck it up. But yeah, just kind of, well, I think it's a sign of man. I was just telling Brooke how I'm Gen X and how we're the greatest generation now. But it's kind of a sign of manliness to show that you can handle the cold, having lived in Grand Rapids for 8 years and a few times scraping ice on the inside of the windshield will build character.
Ooh.
Yeah, we'll build character. And I just wanted to show off that the cold is really just, in the end of the day, a mental obstacle, not really a physical one.
Except when you have to go to the doctors and they cut off one of your fingers because you have frostbite.
Okay, not that cold.
Well, that's how cold I felt, okay? And I'm not a man, so I don't have to show a sign of manliness. And I was cold and I was being a baby about it. But I had a lot of fun.
There wasn't a lot of wind, though. Anybody who's ever been in Chicago and been in between those buildings when the wind is whipping and it's like -5 degrees, and then you got the wind chill on top of that, just whipping through those buildings. That is the worst cold I've ever experienced in my life. It's so miserable. At that point, in that moment in your life, you don't even care if you die. It's that cold. You're just sort of you're just like, just take me, just take me, Lord. Like, I can't deal with this anymore. And that is a brutal, intense cold, especially when like the ice particles are just smashing into your face and it's freezing. It's pretty miserable, Brooke.
I'm actually going to Chicago next week, so that makes me sad.
Yeah, and scared. SPN's in Chicago, but that'll be August, so we'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we'll be fine.
So, I lived in Kansas for a few years though, and it got really, really cold there as well, with lots of wind, but not Chicago cold. But it was still probably like 10 degrees for.
Are there any buildings in Kansas, or is it just like wheat fields?
I lived right outside of Kansas City, so
is that the breadbasket state?
I have no idea.
What? You lived there?
Yeah, I didn't pay attention to that.
I think it's the breadbasket
state. I don't know. Well, Ray would know because he's a history buff and knows random facts like that. But so I've developed a little bit of resiliency. But then you come here to North Carolina and the coldest it gets like 30 degrees, maybe 25 for a couple days.
Yeah, it can get down colder than that at night, you know, when it's it'll get down colder. It'll get down into like the single digits at night sometimes.
But Colorado Springs was wonderful. We had a good time and it was a very, very good conference, and excited to hear about what people in other states that are in the policy space are doing and the ways in which they are working to defend liberty, to limit the scope of government so that people can truly flourish. That's a beautiful thing about going to these sort of events.
We were told not to use the word flourish in our media training.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Flourish, flourish, flourish.
Brooke, stop. You're breaking the rules. You're not supposed to use flourish.
Because I'm an individual.
Because it doesn't help people kind of bring them to your view. It sounds too high and mighty or arrogant, the word flourish.
The Civitalk audience understands.
They do. Our audience is much more urbane and sophisticated, so I don't worry about that so much.
Very astute. So, okay, but let's talk about something that is really bothering both of us, and that has to do with ABC, NBC, mass media cover-up, from Jeffrey Epstein to Harvey Weinstein to Matt Lauer. What the heck is going on?
It's disappointing, Brooke. Just, I think, you know, I've always been distrustful of corporate media. I mean, some of these shills are making tens of millions of dollars. I'm not against people making money, but, you know, you wonder at some point, are they really digging up the truth, or are they just kind of protecting their institution and their branding, which, you know, to some degree you understand. But, you know, these people, to me, aren't really interested in the truth. They're interested in sort of transforming culture to their image. They're interested in storytelling, which they often do a good job of that, but they're not really interested in investigative journalism so much and telling the truth as it is, and being that person that goes out and kind of finds a great story, uncovers a great story. And we've seen now, if it impacts them in any way, they're not interested in the truth at all. In fact, they'll actively cover up the truth. So it's just different. It's just very disappointing to see, but not really surprising to me to see them cover up, potentially, allegedly cover up more information they had about Jeffrey Epstein, more information they had about individuals attached to him that were abusing and potentially allegedly abusing and going after minors for their own sexual, whatever you want to describe, pleasures, conquests. So to me, it's just, it's a sad thing to see, Brooke, and it makes me even more distrustful of some of the big media in this country. And I think it gives people who are maybe in smaller time media or at local papers a bad rap, you know, because sometimes they get lumped into these forces, even though that they're doing their best to go out there and cover the news.
Right. So. Especially given that. So there's a lot to unpack in what you just said. But before I dig into the ABC scandal that just broke recently, a lot of smaller media outfits that are local do the hard work of investigation. They're the ones that, for example, on September 11th of this past September 11th, the News and Observer and WRAL Reporters, Carolina Journal, they were at the General Assembly and provided coverage regarding the House's veto override of the budget, whereas the national media ran with fake news stories about this. And so there's a lot related to that, wherein it's much more valuable, I would say, to follow some of the local media outlets because they're going to provide you the most accurate information because they're closest to the ground on that front. But something that you pointed out was how ABC sat on this Jeffrey Epstein story, which, if you've paid attention at all, this is now making headlines, at least in other more conservative media outlets, even if the mainstream doesn't want to expose it. But ABC had stories about Jeffrey Epstein for about 3 years, yet they sat on them, they kept burying them, disregarding them, and these were stories that could very well implicate him and those with him so as to protect some of the innocent women and young girls that they were abusing. And they sat on it for the sake of having an interview with William and Kate because the palace apparently had heard that Prince Andrew was someone that was implicated.
Yeah, and he's been implicated for another years, allegedly, maybe being involved with Jeffrey Epstein and going down to their little excursions in the, was it the Caribbean, I believe?
Yeah, some island.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the island.
Yeah, and so ABC decided to bury the story, or not even bury it, they just didn't even publish it. And so it was at the expense of these innocents, and the same with...
Well, the Hillary Clinton campaign. I mean, this is a big part of it. If Bill Clinton, as Amy, I think it's Amy Roback. I don't remember the name of the... I've seen her on the news before. I know she used to be on 2020 and other segments of ABC. But if it's true, and Bill Clinton had some kind of involvement with this, and they covered this up to for the advantage of the Hillary Clinton campaign, it just shows their partisan nature to a deeper degree. I mean, we already see it. We already know that the media, especially the corporate media, are shills for the left for the most part. I mean, I think you can say that and not, that doesn't mean that you agree with everything that's going on in the right or everything that's going on and with Trump or this or that. But I think you can agree, at least from a kind of a 10,000 foot view, that the left, you know, and the corporate media are in bed together on so many issues that face this nation. And so if they were actively covering up anything disgraceful or potentially, at least potentially, that looked bad for the former president to protect Hillary Clinton. Just mind-numbing, but not really that surprising given some of the news that we've seen lately. Just in this whole, you know, just going into this whole sexual abuse scandal, the amount of cover-up that we've had by the... It's so hypocritical because, you know, so many of these groups claim to be pro-feminist and pro-women. So many of these media conglomerates, they run stories about just whether it be wage inequality or other kind of issues, but then inside their own organizations to actively cover up sexual abuse, sexual trauma of women is disgusting to me, and it just really just shows the true nature of who they are and what they represent, I think.
Disgusting indeed. And something that I read by David French, who is no longer with the National Review, he's with the Dispatch, which is Jonah
Goldberg's the new outlet. Like Never Trump type of thing.
I don't know if they're exclusively Never Trump. Bulwark is, I would say, but maybe Dispatch is as well, but Jonah Goldberg is, and so is David French. But what he was talking about was, what are some of the reasons why the media would cover this up or not really give it proper attention when there are real lives in danger or at risk of just being permanently marred by this sort of abuse? And so, yes, power is one of them. Money is one of them. But also they pointed out relationships, because we are often much more inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to somebody that is that we're close to, mm-hmm. and that we know personally. And so we have we want to continue to extend goodwill, and that can be a pitfall for anybody on it,
sure.
either side of the aisle or any belief system. And so it's a call toward integrity and doing the right thing, even when it's very, very unpopular within your circle. And again, I mean, we can't say it enough. You guys, you're watching, listening, you know this. I mean, it was just an epic failure and a dereliction of duty toward one's fellow man for ABC and NBC to behave these ways. Yet, once again, it just highlights this deprivation of humanity that people would prioritize the money, the power, or also just wanting to stay in good relationship with people, and other people end up suffering as a result of it.
Yeah, the thing that makes me most upset about this stuff is the way that there's just a double standard. You have to play by these rules. The media kind of sets down these rules about society and says you must play by them. You must be this way or that way, but we have a different standards for ourselves because we have money and power. And I think we see that in all of our culture to some degree, and that really bothers me, mm-hmm. when you try to create a society and segment where, you know, these are the rule of law, this is the way it should be, and this is the cultural norms. But no, we don't follow that because we are set to our own standards because of our money, because of our power, because of our influence. So we'll move on from that. I'm sure this is something we'll discuss again on the podcast, but do some housekeeping real quick. I want everybody to know that we have early bird tickets for sale on CLC.
Yes,
CLC, our Conservative Leadership Conference. So if you want to, what month is that? Is that April?
April,
it's going to be during my birthday. So if you want to come and bring me a birthday cake or a present, come to CLC, because April 18th is my birthday, and we will be celebrating that at some point. You can join in and bringing me presents or some sort of good wishes or goodwills.
I'll buy you a drink.
Okay.
Celebrate it.
Good.
It will be fun. And so, yep, that's April 17th and 18th, and that is here in Raleigh. We have some exciting speakers lined up. We are not able to reveal them yet. Our marketing team, development team, are still hammering out some details, and it's a secret, but the early bird tickets are on sale right now, so you get yourself a phenomenal price for this conference.
Mm-hmm. Good. Save money.
Save money. So go to civitasclc.org. Again, that's civitasclc.org. And we hope to see you there.
And we'll hang out with you. You mentioned the podcast. I will make it an effort to hang out with you.
New best friend.
And give you inside access to what goes on at Civitas. Yes, inside access.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
It'll be fun. He'll tell you all the secrets.
Yeah, all the Brooke secrets you'll ever need to know.
All the scary Brooke secrets. Yep. All the many that there
are. So what next, Brooke? I mean, there's so much to go over. There's just so much in the news right now. What do you want to discuss?
So I want to talk about this crazy idea Cop Kamala Harris came up with regarding...
Why do they call her Cop?
Because she... Okay, well, if you don't know, Kamala Harris used to be the district attorney in California and was very, very tough on crime, which I think a lot of people in our audience could appreciate being tough on crime.
Yeah, for
except sure. when it's unjust and yeah, you kind yeah. of like just have double standards and you're over there chiefing it up, smoking pot and putting people in jail for smoking pot. I mean, that's just like the epitome of just a poor character, which we're going to discuss a little bit more too at length on Governor Cooper. But anyways, so Cop Kamala, though, has decided that, of course, it just doesn't make sense that children get out of school at 2 or 3 o'clock and their parents work till 5. So
it can be kind of aggravating, you know, if you're a two-parent working household and you have someone has to go get the kids. Sometimes that can be very difficult. Yeah. I think a lot of work schedules are becoming a little more flexible right. in some areas, but it can be frustrating. So I get the, you know, the motivation to do more for working parents.
Okay.
You don't?
I don't get the government wanting to.
No, I agree. I agree with you on that.
So that's where I'm coming at this
from. I get the, you know, especially if you have a single parent out there who's kind of like scrapping and trying to save and scrap to get by, that they need some help maybe in terms of childcare. And so, you know, childcare can be very expensive, as I can attest to. Mm-hmm. So I get that aspect of it, but it is kind of crazy that there's some, you know, basically an after-school program for another after-school program.
Right. That's what Kamala Harris has been proposing, is a sort of just extension of the school day so that parents, namely maybe single-parent households, can have their kids go somewhere until they get off of work. I think what it overlooks and kind of hurdles over is this community that should be around these families that can help. And believe me, I mean, I've got 4 kids. We were a military family, did not have families in place next to us that we lived close to that could help us with these things, which is one of the reasons I stayed at home when my husband was deployed and just found other ways to bring in income. Mm-hmm. But to immediately jump to the government providing a solution and keeping kids who oftentimes can't wait to get out of school in school for even longer hours is just, it's ridiculous. I don't like that idea.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in high school, I was always proud of myself that I could make it through the day sometimes without going to the bathroom. So, I think this would cramp that. Kamala Harris. Yeah,
that would be really, really hard to achieve that sort of status.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, in public schools in Mississippi, sometimes you didn't want to go to the bathroom at school. So you had to hold it.
So anyways, I thought that was a lousy proposal, but it's just par for the course with a lot of the Democratic candidates right now, whether it's Elizabeth Warren saying that no middle class taxes are going to be raised in her Medicare for All plan, which is absurd. And no one, even many people on the left, accept that that's actually a legitimate statement that she's made. Of course, middle class taxes are going to go up. And Bernie Sanders is at least honest about it.
Yeah, I'll give credit. Like I've said on the podcast before, you have to give credit to Bernie Sanders for saying middle class tax increases are going to happen. Because mm-hmm. look, the middle class in this America is the largest segment of this country. They hold most of the wealth. So it just makes sense that if you're going to pay for a massive government program like Medicare for All, then you're going to have to basically go and shake down the middle class. That's just straight mathematics. And any time that we've seen in the past where Bill Clinton ran on this, he ran on middle class tax cuts and ended up raising taxes on the middle class, because anytime you restructure the tax code for more tax and spend policies, you're going to have to take a big dent out of the middle class. Because look, I mean, if you're very, very wealthy, yes, you pay most of the taxes, but you also have ways that you can shelter a lot of your wealth overseas through our tax code. And so, you know, you just have to shake down the middle class anytime you go out there and talk about tax increases.
Yeah. So, hats off to Bernie Sanders for at least being honest. Honest on this
burn, feel the burn. I feel it sometimes.
So something interesting, though, was, who was it? Oh man, I lost that train of thought. But I read an article yesterday, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it. We did not discuss this in advance, but I had posted it on Twitter and Facebook. It was from Jonah Goldberg, and it had to do with, he published it in the LA Times and said that Elizabeth Warren and Trump are really two different sides of the same coin. Very, very similar in their populist sort of rhetoric and sort of government intervention approaches to things. So he was saying, you know,
what was the main thing he was talking about for government intervention on Trump?
I think
are you talking about stimulus kind of spending?
Tariffs. I think he cited that. I'll need to go back and reread
the wall
it.
To some degree.
I think more persona, even though their personalities are different, the sort of way in which they were tapping into populism was very, very similar. So
I could see a few similarities, of course, but I think they're very different in a lot of ways. But I mean, in terms of populism, certainly Trump has tapped into this populism, kind of conservative populism. Some people call it nationalism, and I don't mean that as a pejorative. I think there's some positive things that come with nationalism. There can be some negative things too, but I don't mean that as a pejorative. So I could see some similarities. I mean, one of the things that Trump has just been skilled at, I think, is tapping into a lot of forgotten people out there. You could say that about Warren too. I'm not disclaiming she may be tapping into some of that degree too. But I don't know. I guess my concern with Warren, if I was a Democrat, is she going to be able to go into the Midwest and some of these union strongholds that Democrats have traditionally been strong in, and she's going to be able to tap into some of those voters like Trump has been able to do, or steal them back from Trump. And I don't know. I mean, she's so leftist, she may have trouble. And also, when it comes to, you know, a healthcare proposal for all, a lot of these union folks have pretty good medical plans. And so I don't know if she's going to be able to, you know, wrestle that away from them, that issue. So
yeah.
Warren has some built-in disadvantages in this campaign if she's going to run a national campaign in an electoral college, in my opinion. So
yeah, that's what a lot of people seem to think, is that Trump's chances of re-election are much higher if you were to go head-to-head with a Warren
I think
or Sanders
so.
Versus a Biden. Especially when it comes to people in the suburbs.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of different thinking on this with the Democratic Party, because some say they just need to go nominate who they want, or a person like Trump who's going to alienate people and see how they do and how it shakes out. There may be some truth to that. It's hard to say. I mean, Biden, he kind of fits the mold for a lot of the traditional constituencies of the Democratic Party, more so maybe than Sanders and Warren. Maybe he wouldn't do as well with young people, but would do better with older generation who tend to vote at a higher level. Would do obviously do a lot better with black voters. Black voters are not as keen on Sanders. They are a little more keen on Warren, but not to the degree they are on Biden. So it's hard to say, but I mean, it's going to be interesting what happens, Brooke, because you know, Biden's struggling in Iowa, and if he gets bogged down, then I think Warren will pounce, and she could end up being the eventual nominee.
She could certainly become ascendant. And I remembered what I was going to say before that, and we were talking about middle classes and or the middle class and middle class taxes. And I was reading a Bloomberg report the other day. I thought it was interesting that people earning as little as around $22,000 a year and people earning as much as around $250,000 a year identify as middle class. I mean, middle class is just such a broad, sort of elusive, nebulous term that we use. And most Americans feel like they're middle class. Even in the interview, there was a single mom who earned, I think, around $22,000 a year. And she said, you know, I can't afford this. I can't afford that. But I still feel like I can feed my kids at least. And so she considered that middle class. Whereas there was an attorney who earned around $250,000 a year and still felt like, well, I've got student loans. Mm-hmm. I've got all of these other financial obligations of running my firm. And so I'm middle class as well. So
yeah, I think a lot of people like to identify as middle class. You certainly don't want
it's
to be
safe,
seen as like,
isn't it?
Yeah, like a smug, wealthy elitist and you know, with the pocket square in their jacket or, you know, or someone.
If you can't see this podcast, Ray's wearing a pocket square in his jacket.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I'm proud to be middle class, and I think I easily fit into the mold of middle class by categories, just because, you know, it's the middle class that I think really is the backbone of this nation. And the reason we don't go off the cliff, whether it's to the right or the left, is because of the middle class, is because we're the stable aspect of our society, of our culture. And, you know, it's the middle class values that often gets trounced on. We're often the people that kind of take the brunt of bad policies in this country. I mean, the poor to some degree are helped by, you know, let's be honest, sometimes they benefit from a lot of plunder in the tax code. And it's the rich that sometimes they tend to find a way to adapt to anything from a policy perspective, but the middle class often takes the brunt of things. But we're also the folks that I think have kind of a shared work ethic and value in this country that's unmatched anywhere in the world.
It's interesting. Yeah. And despite that, I'd say, though, that there's still a lot of political division among the middle class. I mean, because it's such a broad group of people, it's the majority of Americans. And so I think there's still a lot of disagreement among middle class. However, hardworking is just something that has largely been synonymous with Americans in general, and namely the middle class, I'd say. So that was just like a little bunny trail. But before we end this week's podcast, you and I wanted to spend just a moment talking about Governor Cooper, also bringing you guys some just perspective here in North Carolina. We have had a really, really long a session. It's been a long session. Every odd year here in North Carolina, the General Assembly meets for an extended period compared to the election years, on the even years where they usually only run into like March or April. But this has been an especially long session, which has given us some insights into Governor Cooper, who is obviously not a lawmaker, but he has the power of the veto, and he has vetoed a lot of bills that have come.
He is a chief lawmaker, right? He's the chief lawmaker in the state. Not a legislature, but a lawmaker.
He's an executive. Chief executor. Yeah. So, and a policymaker. I mean, he has policies that he implements. But one of the articles that we put on our website recently was, what can we learn about Governor Cooper from his leadership style? And I think that our audience, just reading some of the Facebook comments, has really been frustrated, and they've expressed frustrations to us about just the way Governor Cooper has led this state. In many ways, he's been able to duck and cover from a lot of controversy, right? But then there are other times where he's just kind of forced to show who he really is. And it's been unfortunate. Whether it was I think the most egregious that both you and I could agree on was his veto of the Infant Survivors Born Alive Protection Act, wherein it would have criminalized infanticide in our state. And yet he chose to play politics. His campaigns received substantial donations from Planned Parenthood, so it's not really much of a surprise. But his treatment of State Treasurer Dale Falwell, when Dale Falwell has tried to hold the Department of Transportation accountable for tens of millions of dollars of overage and spending of taxpayer dollars.
You know, that's a great question.
What?
Who is the real conservative leader in the state? In North Carolina, I just thought about that when
political leader.
Yeah, when Falwell was, you know, where was Forrest? He seemed like he jumped on that train a little bit late. I don't know. Falwell, maybe because Falwell's a little. I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I'm just kind of saying, you know, Falwell has been, I think, probably the best proponent and spokesman for the public purse in North Carolina.
For the public, yeah, absolutely.
And so he, you know, Lieutenant Governor's role is a little bit different than Falwell's role, but I'll just say I've been really impressed with the way Falwell has kind of engaged on this issue in an aggressive manner, in terms of just being a protector of the taxpayer's purse, because you don't see that a lot in government. And he's been pretty aggressive from a standpoint of really looking out for the taxpayer. And I'm not saying anything negative about Forrest, but he's just, to me, I just personally, it's been impressive to kind of see him go out there and really challenge the big spenders in the state.
I think some state employees, though, would take some issue with Treasurer Falwell's handling, though, of pension reform and things, healthcare.
Well, that definitely hurt. Like that. I mean, we didn't get into it today, but the Kentucky governor went down in large part because he tried to take on pension reform. He didn't do it very tactfully, but it's something a lot of governors are going to and legislators need to address.
With it.
Yeah, you got to deal with it.
No one wants to deal with it.
Nobody wants to deal with it.
Takes courage.
You don't deal with it, you're going to end up like our federal government, $23 trillion in debt. Oof. And no way out. You know, then you're going to have to basically plunder future generations to ever dig your way out. So,
right.
But yeah, I'm sorry I sidetracked.
No,
you there.
No. I think that's a good point to make. And so one of the things in this article was that just the way Governor Cooper treated Treasurer Falwell and his office, the way that they behaved toward him, as well as the way in which Governor Cooper and his administration has handled the Atlantic Coast Pipeline investigation, where it looked like there may have been some quid pro quo. And so investigators who are retired federal agents were brought in, and Governor Cooper and his office were extremely dismissive of them. Governor Cooper encouraged state employees to stonewall investigators for a period of time. So there's just there have been a lot of things that have happened over the past 3 years of Governor Cooper's time here in office. Mm-hmm. That have not have led to some questions, probably more questions than answers. And I think he's largely been able to stay out of the line of fire. But with the election coming up, I'm wondering if this is, if these are going to be some things that if he doesn't deal with them head on and sort of come at it from more of a look, the character and integrity matter. So I'm going to be forthright with the voters. I think that it could bite him later.
One last question kind of before we close out here, Brooke, but do you think because his polling, I know it's dropped a little bit in the last few months, but do you think because his polling is pretty much above water and a bit is solid for the most part? I mean, we know this from just our Civitas polls. I know he does some internal polls, I'm sure, but do you think he just kind of says, well, it's working. You know, I'm not really going to change my ethics or behavior because what I'm doing is working. And it's clear, I think the media, we would all agree, whether you're on the right or left, at least you should agree, that they're pretty soft on Cooper. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not doing a little bit lately. They've been kind of
They put some more pressure on
put a little
lately.
More ink out there, kind of asking him to step up. But I mean, for the most part, for his tenure overall, they've been pretty soft on him. But you think he doesn't feel like he needs to change because he feels like, well, I'm polling well, I'm set up well for re-election.
Yeah. I absolutely do. I think that that is the political maneuver that most of his advisors would give to him is, look, lay low, just when there's a hurricane or a disaster, you know, get in front of the cameras at that point in time, but otherwise avoid being entangled with any sort of media engagements or optics that could possibly put you in a bad light.
Yeah.
And so I think because he has not been super engaging, that has boded well for him because then he doesn't have opportunities to mess up. When you put yourself out there, you're gonna blunder sometimes.
He's too far left for the state because we tend to be, you know, just from a, and I'm not saying you can't have a governor who's to the right of the state or to the left of the state. That happens all the time in many states across the country. But Cooper's clearly, to me, too far to the left for North Carolina. So it makes sense for him to lay low and not take a strong position, at least publicly, on a lot of these issues until he's forced in a corner, which the General Assembly kind of got late to the boat on doing that to him a little bit more lately. But, you know, it makes sense to me that he would kind of lay low. He's too far left for North Carolina. There's not one issue that he deviates from national Democrats on. There's not, I can't find one. So if anybody's out there, feel free to put in the comments. Or
if you're vetoing an infanticide bill, you're pretty far left.
Yeah, and you're with the national Democrats on every issue. I mean, everything that comes across Cooper's desk or everything he comments on, nothing is outside of Democrats. I mean, certainly Trump, at least traditionally, you know, he certainly delineates from the Republican Party on some issues, but Cooper, no, he's lockstep with them at this point.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of our analysis. You can find that on our website at nccivitas.org. But we have to close it out for this week. Thank you guys so much for joining
us. Thank you. Happy Veterans Day to our veterans out there.
Yes,
so by the time you listen to this, maybe Monday,
right? It will
be
released on Veterans Day.
So happy veterans out there to our service members.
Thank you. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.